Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are the Beatle Brains of Ireland, and we host Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles.
We might look at Beatles albums, we might tell you what books you need to be taking on holiday. We've done an episode from Abbey Road Studios, and we do live shows.
We've also had guests on our podcast, like Beatles biographer Mark Lewison and singer-songwriter Robin Hitchcock. Search for Nothing Is Real on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Available 8 days a week.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Christ, you know it ain't easy. The Ballad of John and Yoko is a unique song in the Beatles canon. It was their last number one. And when we look at the Beatles' last active year of service in 1969, does it give us any clues as to how they could have functioned in the 70s? While Get Back and Abbey Road are two perspectives, the Ballad of John and Yoko, it kind of gives us a third perspective, doesn't it, Stephen?
Yes, I mean, I suppose it's almost a John solo project, and you can see a situation in the 70s where they were coming together. See what I did there? you know, every year, every other year, doing a group album, doing solo projects. And this is a period where, you know, each of the four are doing solo projects, whether that's recording other Apple artists or films or music projects. There's Apple label projects, but this, I suppose, is the first time, maybe the only occasion, on which a John, in inverted commas, solo project is actually encroaching onto the Beatles turf.
Yeah, and it's their last standalone single as well, which is interesting for a band who had done so many standalone singles, which you sometimes don't totally connect with their surrounding albums. You know, you don't often think of We Can Work It Out should be on Rubber Soul, but even though they're of the same era. So it's curious that even at that late stage in their career, they thought, no, we can still knock out a standalone single.
Well, they knocked out the standalone single while their previous standalone single was still in the charts. So it's the whole concept and a sort of development and execution of this project is very strange.
It is. And it's, as I said, it's kind of totally unique. So the Ballad of John and Yoko, you know, it's obviously totally autobiographical. There's nowhere to hide within the song. It is about the thing it is about. And, you know, it kind of arrives at a peak John and Yoko period where they're John and Yokiest that they can possibly be.
This really launches them. This period really launches them as that John and Yoko, that single entity. They're on the front page of every newspaper, not just in the UK but sort of all around the world. And this song is effectively a diary which explains exactly how they went from being John Lennon and Yoko Ono to being John and Yoko.
Yeah.
It is, Lennon in 1980 said, this is just a piece of journalism. And he described it back in 1969 as Johnny B. Paperback Writer. you know, so it's similar, I suppose, to New York City, the song on Sometime in New York City, which is just a piece of reportage about what they were doing.
Well, it's a point we'll probably come back to, is that, you know, it kind of sets up a new style of Lennon writing and Lennon music, because it is totally autobiographical and it's chronological as well. And that's kind of what we're going to pull the thread on today, is to actually look at this song and say this is a chronological coverage of only about 2 to 3 weeks in their lives. May we all be so busy, but it does work in terms of, you know, they've often said that you know, the Bedouins were an advertising campaign for peace. And this song is part of the advertising campaign for John and Yoko.
It is. I think, you know, we can't forget that. Although it's a peace campaign, this is very much about, you know, I suppose in modern terms, it would be the media launch. It's a brand launch for John and Yoko. And he's enlisting the most famous rock group in the world to do the heavy lifting.
Yeah. Or is he? Is it all of the group? We'll come to that later on. So, yeah, The Ballad of John Yoko is, if you take it as its constituent parts, it's kind of a dull song telling the story. But the opening line, Standing in the Dock at Southampton, is an event that happened on the 15th of March, 1969. And it is a credit to their lives that they make it so entertaining. But to know how they get to that point on the 15th of March, 1969, we need to rewind back to the start of 69 and just briefly have a walk through all the things that happened. Because obviously January 1969 is Get Back, Let It Be. And yeah, I'm sure most people listening to this will recall that project, you know, the concert on the roof and all that kind of thing. But then you get into February, which is this kind of a bit of a no man's land in Beatle terms.
Yeah, it sort of tips immediately from that concert on the roof.
Which is, there's so much activity in January. Like it's so dense.
Yes. And it's all about the music. And for all of the sort of fractious period that is, it ends on a real high with that rooftop performance. And then 1st of February 1969, they're literally back down to earth. They're back at Savile Row. There's a meeting in which Alan Klein is giving his overview, his assessment of what their finances are like. And he's obviously painting as bleak a picture as he can. Also present is John Eastman, who is soon to be Paul's father-in-law. So they're straight back into chasing paper. You know, it's about money. It's about business.
Yes. And this is the time where Klein is basically trying to get his control.
Yes, he's really pitching very hard at this stage to come in and take control. John Eastman and Paul are on the other side. Paul is obviously wanting John Eastman to come in. And there's a split here between Eastman as the lawyer, Klein as the notionally an accountant, but coming from a financial side. And there's a series of meetings in which it's a bit of a tug of war between those two factions.
And you know, books have been written about, you know, the decline of Apple and, you know, what happened at that time. But, you know, in the heat of the moment, I'm not saying I can understand why Ringo, George and John went with Alan Klein, but you actually kind of can, because they would say, you know, well, he's our guy and, you know, he has form and he seems, you know, the thing about Klein is he seemed to sell himself pretty well. He wasn't shy.
No, he sells himself well. And, you know, we see this with John. You know, he latches on to a particular character or he latches on to a particular cause, and it's a wholehearted 100% endorsement. So very quickly, feels he's got the measure of Klein and he's the guy for the Beatles. He's certainly the one he wants representing him. And George and Ringo, essentially, I think without any great independent investigation of Klein.
They didn't do due diligence.
You know, they sort of, John is the leader. John thinks this guy is good. But there is a lot going on in February, which is in parallel with this. So this is, again, the fascinating thing that they can be arguing about management issues, about legal issues, about financial issues. But at the same time, they're working together. They're producing music. I mean, the first thing that really happens is George absents himself for a week to go and have his tonsils out.
Those pesky tonsils, you know, that kept him off the stage in 64.
So you think this is probably the first week he's had an opportunity to, possibly, in 5 years to get that done.
He could have had them done in India, maybe.
Oh, I don't know about that. Are you recommending that?
No, I'm not.
All right. Okay. But it's like there's work going on. So Paul is working with Mary Hopkin at this stage on the 13th of February. There's a launch party for her album, postcards. So Paul's there. Linda is very much there. Jimi Hendrix pops up. Eric Clapton, Donovan, members of Mary Hopkins' family. You think that must be kind of weird.
And this is the top of the post office tower, which is one of my favorite buildings in London. I used to work around the corner, and I've never managed to get up to the rotating restaurant at the top of Tony Benn's post office tower. It was a fascinating building.
Does it still rotate?
It hasn't rotated in a while. And it was due to reopen again in 2012 for the London Olympics and and maybe for a spin, but it hasn't spun. But if anyone knows that building, it's a fantastic piece of pop, 60s pop art almost itself.
It's very 60s. It's a kind of iconic thing. So Apple is still continuing. Apple is, you know, that side of the business. 22nd of February, they start work on I Want You. So again, we talked about this before. This is a very short period between the supposedly fractious sessions, and then they're straight into, you know, 22 days later, they're making a start on a song that turns up on Abbey Road.
And those sessions for I Want You are, they're a bit more clearly laid out in the Abbey Road box set. You can actually hear that Trident Studios. So it's not Abbey Road, they're in Trident Studios. It's the take where, you know, they get a warning from a neighbor that they're making too much noise.
Yes.
But it's Billy Preston is there. And yeah, it is the link performance between all the Get Back stuff and all the Abbey Road stuff. And, you know, it's a fantastic performance if any of you out there haven't heard it already. So that brings us through February. And, you know, Paul and Linda, it's worth keeping in the back of our mind that they are an item. And, you know, the hindsight with John Eastman is that we think, oh, yeah, he would have been the good, wise choice, because the Eastmans go on to manage Paul's career or his affairs to this day in some respects. But, you know, the Eastmans are still a very new, unknown quantity to the rest of the Beatles. You know, it's not a given that they are the guys per se.
It's the flip side of that Klein coin. It's just Paul saying, well, hey, I just met somebody and her dad is a lawyer. So,
yes, let's choose them.
Let's choose them. It's just typical. Maybe it's just typical of the way things were being done in the 60s. You know, you flipped a coin or consulted the I Ching and
that gave you your answer.
That gave you your answer. But they're clearly, I mean, there's a very telling split between Paul and John about what they're doing on the 2nd of March. So Paul is in the studio producing Mary Hopkins singing Goodbye. If you know that's again a demo of that appears, very kind of nice little acoustic song. John on that same date is on stage with Yoko at Cambridge University performing what would sort of 20 minutes of Howling Feedback and Yoko screaming, and this would go on to be side two of Life with the Lion. So you couldn't get a bigger disparity, approaches to what they're doing musically at this time.
And that's John. So that's the 2nd of March, 1969. And when John gives that concert performance, and it's the first, essentially first appearance of any solo Beatle in any kind of concert setting ever.
Yes. Yes. I mean, they haven't appeared on stage since Candlestick Park in 66. So this is him suddenly, it was an avant-garde music festival. And some people in those circles were a bit sniffy about John turning up, but it's all there.
It's all there. And there's a plaque on the wall of the building to this day to celebrate the happening. And the other thing that happens right at the end of February 69 is George, on his 26th birthday, does those three solo sessions that eventually turn up on Anthology 3 for Old Brown Shoe, Something and All Things Must Pass, those lovely solo acoustic demos. So that's all happening at that time. So we're into March 1969 and we're still slowly gravitating towards Standing in the Dock at Southampton. But as you say, there's still Apple business going on. So, you know, George is being interviewed about Beatle rumours at the start of March.
Yes. So we tend to think, the Let It Be film is what laid bare the sort of divisions within the band. But these arguments and this tension, this was well known and was being reported on at the time in the music press. And George gives an interview to David Wigg for the BBC and has to specifically address the stories and saying, no, I didn't leave. No, I didn't get into a physical fight with John. So this is all out in the press and being reported on. And, but again, they're just downplaying this, and there's we talked about this again, you know, previously, you get a sense that they sort of drift into the back end of 1969. They're still trying to preserve this illusion of unity.
Yeah. But also they know no different. So that leads to Tuesday, the 11th of March, where, you know, we have an unusual setup where Paul and George are working together on an Apple session.
This is very interesting to me because, again, because of that argument that's enshrined in the Let It Be film, you tend to think the big split was between George and Paul. But this is another example of them working together, the Beatles working together, you know, when the tapes start rolling and the music is being played, they can do that. And this is a session for Jackie Lomax, who was a Liverpool singer that they had known from the early days in Liverpool and had brought on to the Apple label. So, they're recording his next single. And this is Paul and George collaborating to help an old friend.
Yeah, and it seems all very organic. And I don't know, I'm sure Jackie Lomax is kind of playing that Billy Preston role of, you know, keeping everyone in good behavior, you know, working towards a common goal. Don't let anyone down.
Don't let yourself down in front of your friends. That's
yes. But the thing that might, you know, ironically, that might have fired the starting gun for the Ballad of John and Yoko, or for the events of the Ballad of John and Yoko, because they all, you know, the events that are covered in the Ballad of John and Yoko all seem, when you look at them in close up, a little bit spontaneous would be the polite way to say it, or chaotic would be the more reasonable way to say it. But on the 14th of March 1969, Paul marries Linda. And this is, Linda is pregnant at this time, which, you know, might have been the catalyst for this to be in a speedy or efficient or underannounced, shall we say, wedding.
But I think that's what prompts it to happen at this particular time. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the 14th of March, 1969. And as far as we know, John does not know that Paul is heading off to marry Linda on that day.
No. And it seems to have been quite secretive that was happening.
It is very, very, it's very curious that Paul and John end up getting married within the same period of time, that they are two close guys. And, you know, can we say with any certainty that Paul marrying Linda was the impetus for him to marry Yoko?
It seems to me to be, this cannot be a
coincidence. Cannot be unrelated.
It cannot be a coincidence because, you know, you have this sense that you know, Paul had obviously, it's not just that they woke up on that morning and decided, hey, Linda, let's get married. You know, there was some planning in that, but it was done in a way that none of the other Beatles were involved. John's decision to marry, or John and Yoko's decision to marry, seems just completely instantaneous on the day. It is literally that they woke up one day and decided to get married. And it just happens to be the day that his erstwhile best friend and songwriting buddy and chief rival is doing the same thing. It may have been nothing more than the media scrum that suddenly surrounded McCartney's wedding. Yeah. You know, you'll have seen the news footage of you know, them
Marylebone
emerging
registry
and,
office and,
yeah, and right. Sort of screaming girls and, you know, the last unmarried Beatle has got married. So, but yes. there's a lot of media attention focused on this, the Paul and Linda wedding, and that's got to have impacted. You know, we cannot say, short of getting Yoko here to give us her account, but I'm absolutely convinced that it was a spontaneous reaction to the Paul and Linda wedding
situation. So, the Ballad of John and Yoko, let's have a look at it. Standing in the dock at Southampton, trying to get to Holland or France, the man in the Mac said, you got to go back. You know, they didn't even give us a chance. So before they get to Southampton, while Paul is getting married, in another kind of curious sense of foreshadowing, where are John and Yoko?
Yeah, they're barreling down the motorway. I suppose there wasn't a motorway in 1969, but they're barreling.
Well, there were some motorways, but I'm not
barreling
sure.
Down an A or a B road to pull in Dorset so that John could introduce Yoko to his Aunt Mimi.
And
you'd like to have been a fly on the wall.
Well, Aunt Mimi, the pool in Dorset is obviously, it's in southern England, so it's far away from Liverpool, and it's a coastal town, and it's
genteel, I think, isn't
it? Yes, and very kind of full of retirees, as far as I know. But this is a place where, this is a house that John bought for Mimi as kind of a thank you gift.
Yes.
And, you know, we could have an entire episode on John and Mimi, but she's obviously the figure who spent a lot of time bringing him up. She was still alive after John had died. So there's one very significant interview with Mimi from 1981, which actually is on YouTube and takes place in the house in Poole in Dorset that John bought for her. So, you know, she's a very important figure. And we know that throughout the 70s, he kept in touch there, particularly when he was in New York. So it obviously was important for him to introduce Yoko to Mimi.
Yes, it's a very, as you say, there's an entire episode or two or three about the relationship between John and his aunt. But clearly, you know, Yoko was a big part of his life. Mimi is the other woman in his life, and he wants to introduce them. He wants them to get on. But he must have known that they're coming from such different backgrounds that this was never going to be an easy. This was never going to be a meeting of minds between Mimi and Yoko, I think.
And we have some part of that story. I think listening to how Mimi recounts the story, she might not have been the most, tolerant of people? Is that...
Not the most tolerant, not the most diplomatic.
How does she recount the whole thing?
Well, there is a fantastic interview in the Daily Mail. Now, obviously, I wouldn't encourage people to go and read the Daily Mail. But
as interviews go, it's very on-brand for the Daily Mail.
It's very on-brand for the Daily Mail. So there's an interview that she gave to James Montgomery of the Daily Mail. And I'm just going to quote exactly verbatim from this. She says, "He came in all bright and breezy, typical John, and she followed behind. I took one look at her and I thought, my God, what is that? Well, I didn't like the look of her right from the start. She had long black hair all over the place and she was small. She looked just like a dwarf to me. I told John what I felt while she was outside looking across the bay. I said to him, who's the poison dwarf, John?"
Oh, boy. So, I mean, certainly her opinion at that time would have been one that was echoed in an awful lot of newsprint at the time, you know, and it's 50 years plus later, it's still, you know, quite shocking to see in print, but you know, she was saying what a lot of people were saying.
Yes. I mean, it's probably more shocking to modern sensibilities, but it did feed into the sort of anti, you know, this anti-Japanese sentiment. Yeah. There was this idea that, Cynthia had been very badly treated. She was this attractive blonde English girl and she had been divorced, you know, cast aside in favor of this Japanese woman.
Yes.
And so there was this misogyny, this racism, this generational, naturally enough, you know, people who were very vivid memories of the war. So all of this feeds into it. So, you know, John couldn't have chosen a more controversial partner, perhaps in England in the 1960s, if he had tried to do that.
And it's up for psychologists and psychoanalysts to decide how much of that was kind of purposeful or not. But
yeah.
Mimi does recount saying to her, you know, "What do you do for a living?" "I'm an artist," said Yoko. And Mimi says, "That's funny. I've never heard of you." and then she warns John, make of this what you will. She warned John of what happened to the Duke of Windsor, who'd been remarkably popular, but the public had gone off him when he married Mrs. Simpson. "He lost his popularity. And John, you know better than that," Mimi lectured John. I'm sure John took that all on board. But, you know, he had a lifetime at that point of gently ignoring Mimi and still obviously loving her and relying on her.
Yes, again, there's that sort of love-hate relationship. You know, he wanted her approval, but you do get a sense that throughout his entire life, he challenged her conventions. You know, that was what he was kicking against a lot of the time. So this was, while this was happening, Paul is getting married. This is happening on the same day. So again, you've got that very stark contrast. And this is the point during the journey to Mimi's house, supposedly, John asked his chauffeur to go ahead to Southampton and inquire about the possibility of him marrying Yoko at sea.
Yeah, so we're not exactly sure how John heard the news. You know, I'm sure it wasn't on Twitter or whatever the 1969 equivalent was, but himself and Yoko aren't driving themselves. They're being driven by Les Anthony, and it's Les Anthony who's like, let's go to Southampton. Isn't that the general plan?
That's it. He's the sort of gopher. So it seems to be that he is sort of dispatched to find out, is this possible to get married on the romantic setting of the cross-channel ferry? You know, I'm sure that would have been lovely. But we talked just a little bit about Les Anthony. He passed away just last year.
Yeah.
But he was a former Welsh Guardsman who landed the job of becoming the Beatles' chauffeur, and he very quickly sort of became part of their inner trusted circle. And the story seems to be that Brian Epstein saw him washing a car and went over and had a chat with him, and the next thing just literally walked him across the road to John's house and said, you know, this guy would be very good. You know, he's kind of tall, ex-army, provided an element of security as well. And increasingly he became Lennon's designated driver. He once drove the Rolls Royce from London to Spain to pick Lennon up, you know, as you would. It's like the ultimate Uber.
Yes, come and get me. And but he works for Lennon until he suddenly doesn't work for Lennon. Isn't that what happens?
Yes, it's whenever John and Yoko moved to New York, his employment came to an end, and you know, they seem to have been in very good terms, and he got a brief note saying, again, I quote, "You've been a good lad over the years and faithful, for which I thank you." And then 12 months later, Anthony is on the receiving end of a writ because he's given an interview to the News of the World. Again, another.
Yes. Well, it's already name checked.
We can say what we like. It's a deceased newspaper, so we can say what we like. But it's a bit of a scandal sheet. And again, he says the offending line that resulted in these proceedings was, it took about 3 weeks to start the breakup of the Beatles. They were the 3 weeks from the day when Yoko bumped into John Lennon until the night she climbed into his bed. So again, you know, it just feeds into that story. And you know, what can you say?
I know,
He was sued for his trouble.
So Lennon does recount that, you know, we wanted to get married on the cross-channel ferry. That was the romantic part. So we went to Southampton, and then we couldn't get on because she, Yoko, wasn't English, and she couldn't get the day visa to go across. You know, so freedom of movement was an issue there. And they said, anyway, you can't get married. The captain's not allowed to do it anymore. So it's all a bit sort of antiquated, you know, these kind of type of old movies, the let's get married on the ship type thing, you know.
I'm kind of picturing a James Robertson Justice type captain from, you know, Doctor at Large or Doctor at Sea.
That's a reference for the kids there.
It's all very kind of late 60s stock British English, you know, genteel movies. And yeah, let's get married. See, but it's the very idea that in 1980 he was still saying we wanted to get married on a cross-channel ferry. That was the romantic part.
Yeah, I mean, speaking as someone who's been on cross-channel ferries. Yeah, they're not the most romantic of places.
Do you think if you had asked your good lady wife to get married on the cross channel ferry, that would have been that would have been well received?
No, I don't think so. So that's the first verse. Next verse. Finally made the plane into Paris, honeymooning down by the Seine. Peter Brown called to say, you can make it okay. You can't get married in Gibraltar near Spain.
Can I just say, I'm bitterly disappointed that you're not singing these, but anyway. Oh,
sorry. Let me get my 12 string. Where's it gone? But this is Sunday, the 16th of March, 1969. And that's the day when they finally make the plane into Paris. So John and Yoko fly to Paris on that day it's a private plane, isn't it?
They charter a private plane, which to my way of thinking, call me old fashioned, but that's more romantic than a cross channel ferry.
Certainly, you know, it feels like you're going places if you're hiring your own plane for your wedding. And, you know, Peter Brown goes down in history by getting a name check in this song. He sort of gets a, you know, Neil Aspinall never got a name check in a song, but Peter Brown has probably made a living out of getting a name check in this song. And he's obviously the go-between that Lennon keeps ringing. Sort this out.
He is. I was trying to think, is there anybody else that has got a full name check? You know, like Bungalow Bill was a real character, and the only other ones I could think of were Mr. Wilson and Mr. Heath in Taxman. But I think Peter Bryan is gets a full name check. So yeah, he's in London. He doesn't get to go on the private plane. so he's tasked with this idea of, you know, get me a license. I want to get married in Paris. Again, quite romantic, but yes. he has to ring up and say, look, I'm really sorry. It may have escaped your attention, but you're not French. and you can't just sort of rock up into any country and decide you're going to get married. But he does tell them that they can get married in Gibraltar, that it's a British protectorate or British colony, I suppose, the last of the European British colonies. And so again, they charter another plane and fly to Gibraltar. And, you know, this is a necessity. They've decided to get married. So it's a necessity that they do this and that they fly to Gibraltar. But retrospectively, John, perhaps making up for the lack of romance associated with the Channel Ferry, says, you know, it's the Pillar of Hercules. It was beautiful. There's a sense of mystery. It's like the gateway to the world. And we liked it in the symbolic sense. And it was the rock foundation of our relationship. And not just, it was the only place we could find that would give us a license.
Yeah, they're kind of knocking off these places one by one. You know, he believes, you know, oh, I need 3 weeks residence in Germany, 2 weeks residence in France. And yeah, Peter Bryan sort of comes up with this idea that Gibraltar is the place to go. And it's, you know, I'm still always amused by the fact that it's Gibraltar near Spain, you know,
near Spain, near
as opposed
Spain.
To attached to Spain or, you know, the other people with other political ideologies.
We're straying into all sorts of international diplomatic minefields here.
But they do get married on the 20th of March, 1969, at the registry office in Gibraltar, near Spain. Have you ever been to Gibraltar, Stephen?
I have. I have not only been to Gibraltar, I have stayed overnight in Gibraltar.
Oh my gosh. I went to Gibraltar once, but I didn't stay overnight. What's your take on Gibraltar, if we can sidestep?
I was staying in Spain and I sort of up the coast and I got a bus down, and just at the spur of the moment, I decided, you know, I couldn't find anybody to get married to, but I just spur of the moment thought, well, never mind that, I'll go to Gibraltar anyway. And I thought Gibraltar was charming. The weather was very nice, beautiful old streets. I stayed in a very nice little hotel. I had the best scrambled eggs for breakfast I've ever had anywhere in the world. I went up the cable car. It was great. And then I got a bus and headed back up to finish my sunbathing, lounging by the pool holiday in Spain.
I spent a day there and I'd been advised, which in retrospect was very stupid, that you just park at the border and then walk into Gibraltar, which is stupid because anyone who's been there knows that, you know, it's this little kind of peninsula that sticks out, and right across the border is this airport.
Yes, so the runway. You have to walk across the runway.
So if you're walking into Gibraltar, you have to like walk across the runway like a zebra crossing. It's crazy, and it's like a little time capsule of 70s Britain when you get into the streets of Gibraltar itself. All these shops and things that you haven't really seen in a while. But I did get to the square where Lennon got married, and that was the important part of getting to Gibraltar.
That was the important part. But you know, for all the romance attached to that, it was 10 minutes. They were there for 10 minutes, and the registrar Cecil Wheeler, he didn't get name checked in the song, unfortunately, but so he marries them, and then within an hour they're back on the plane flying back to Paris. So
yeah, and I'm assuming they're on that runway that I had to cross. That's how they get back to Paris. Maybe that was the same. I'm assuming that airport was there at the time.
That must be the actual runway that their private plane is. That where your
exciting
private plane landed?
No, rental car. So they get married on the 20th of March, 1969, and that is 6 days after Paul marries Linda. So, you know, I don't know how the papers were playing this contemporaneously at the time, but it must have been a field day to have two Beatles, John and Paul, married within the week. That's a pretty intense.
That's pretty intense. I'd say both of these events completely out of the blue as far as the press and media would have been concerned.
Yes. So they go back to Paris, and there's one interesting meeting back in Paris, isn't there?
Yes, so they're just kind of kicking around Paris, but they meet Salvador Dali and his wife Gala, and they have lunch. So again, that's a lunch you would have wanted to be at the next table in the restaurant. So you've got John and Yoko, Salvador Dali and his wife, and history does not record if Dali brought along his pet lobster.
He's famous
for having a pet lobster that he would walk around Paris on a lead. How quickly do lobsters walk? I don't know.
I think he was just doing it for show, Stephen.
You think?
Yes.
Exhibition. Doesn't sound like Dali to me.
But Dali wanted to collaborate, or Dali was kind of coming up with ideas.
Yes. So, and again, it's another, you think that would be a thing to mention in the song.
It is funny, out of all the things that don't get a mention in the song, you know, Peter Brown gets a mention and Salvador Dali doesn't.
Yes.
Which is the charm of the song, I suppose.
I think so. But perhaps it's also that, you know, you don't want to be upstaged in your own song by Salvador Dali.
That is true.
You know, mentioning Salvador Dali or any that kind of waters down the this is about me.
Yeah.
You know, this is not about Salvador Dali. And you would think that would be, if not a match made in heaven, that they would have things to talk about and projects that they might like to collaborate on. And Robert Whittaker, the photographer.
Yeah.
He says Dali was a huge Lennon fan. And it said he kept a photograph of John Lennon hanging from a coat hanger on his wall. So if you wanted to do that yourself, take all your photographs down and hang them up using coat hangers. There's a very good book called One Day at a Time by Anthony Fawcett, who became John and Yoko's assistant around this time. And he talks about the possibility of a collaboration. And he says he once had a meeting with Dali, who was very anxious to work with John, and that Dali made an object using flowers, napkins, makeup, gold paint, and said that, you know, take this artwork back to John. But Fawcett explicitly says that Lennon was not interested in collaborating with Dali.
Yeah.
Despite the fact that there were quite a few overtures made by Dali at this time.
And Dali was 64 at this time. He had nothing left to prove. He was Salvador Dali. You know, he was at the legend that was Salvador Dali. But John and Yoko spend a couple of days honeymooning down by the Seine, which, you know, if you're looking at the strict chronology of the song, they're honeymooning before they actually get married. But we'll forgive them that.
You're being a bit pedantic there. Well,
that's the whole point
you're
of every
being like
podcast
a lawyer.
Ever.
Yeah.
But they have a little break there in Paris. So we shall take a little break and we'll be right back after this.
End of part one. Intermission.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
End of intermission. Part two.
Welcome back. So the ballad of John and Yoko then continues. Drove from Paris to the Amsterdam Hilton, talking in our beds for a week. The news people said, say what you're doing in bed. I said, we're only trying to get us some peace. So this is obviously a verse that even the most casual John and Yoko fan would have recognized the bed-ins that are being referenced to here. And they've already covered, you know, car ferries, private planes, and now we're going to drive from Paris to Amsterdam, which is a 300-mile, 500-kilometer journey that takes 5 to 6 hours.
Yeah, but they're in a Rolls Royce.
They're in a Rolls Royce with a record player and a television. What a way to travel. And so drove from Paris to the Amsterdam Hilton happens on Tuesday, the 25th of March.
25th, that's it. So they check into the Hilton, and naturally enough, they get the best room in the house, which is the presidential suite. That was room 902.
Okay.
although it's room 702 now. So I don't know how they've remodeled, but they've renumbered. And they're there until the 31st of March. John talks about this in one of the interviews in Anthology, and he said the first bed-in was held in Amsterdam on our honeymoon, and we sent out a card saying, come to John and Yoko's honeymoon, a bed-in Amsterdam hotel. And this is where he makes the point that the press, this is not long after the Two Virgins album has come out, and I suppose you could say that that's the thing that John and Yoko are perhaps at this point most famous for, is taking their clothes off on an album cover. Yep. So the press think, you know, there's going to be some sexy goings on, some shenanigans, and are very disappointed that John's in his stripy flannel pajamas, is something his grandfather might have worn. And they're there just to give interviews. And from 9 in the morning until 9 at night, they're lying in bed giving interviews.
Yeah, and we kind of take the, you know, the iconography of what the bed-ins are, we kind of take them for granted now. And obviously there was a second bed-in later on in Montreal in May of the year. But yeah, as you say, it's only 3 to 4 months since the Two Virgins album cover came out. So yeah, we might think of the bed-ins as being this, you know, of them literally being in bed. But it's a totally reasonable assumption to say, if you get this blind invite, that, well, why, you know, they might just be naked in bed, you know?
Yes,
let's go see what's going on.
Exactly. Why would they not be taking their clothes off? They've done it before. And
but it is kind of funny that it's obviously a classic bait and switch that they're saying to the... Yes. They obviously knew that this whole potential titillation would just drive people in. And it's actually hilariously funny that it's so mundane what they're doing once the press get there.
It is. I mean, I think you're right there. At this point, they are manipulating the media.
Yeah.
And they are in control. You know, they've got the press there. What are the press going to do? Are they going to just say, oh, he's got pajamas on, let's just leave, there's nothing here for us? You know, they are there. They've got the attention. They are manipulating the media at this point.
Yeah. So the notion that they might be doing some kind of public lovemaking session isn't totally unusual, but they are, as we said, kind of harnessing the moment to try and get people's attention. And here we are still talking about it 50 plus years later. So some of it must have worked.
If it wasn't a COVID situation, we could go and broadcast we could record an episode in that very room. We could put on our pajamas and lie on the bed.
That's
and,
not going to happen.
And
that's like Eric and Ernie style.
I was thinking it's like Morecambe and Wise. So you can still go and say it's room 702. And I'm going to read you out that this has now become advertising. It says City View Balcony Living Area, John and Yoko Memorabilia. What would that be? A cup that they drank out of, or perhaps the signs. You also get executive lounge access, and it said, treat yourself to a piece of history in the suite made famous by John. The suite features one kingside Hilton Serenity bed and is decorated with only natural materials and unique John and Yoko memorabilia. I think we've got to go there.
Okay, so we've got to go there, and we've got to go to the other hotel out in the west of Ireland, and all these John and Yoko.
We could each go to one hotel.
that's spaced out enough. So they basically give a week-long press conference. Do we have any, like, this starts on Tuesday, the 25th of March, when they're talking in their beds for a week. Do we have any notion of when specifically the idea happens? I'm assuming it kind of percolates in the days that they're in Paris, but it again, it's very spontaneous / chaotic.
Again, chaotic is the word. It does seem to me that it must have been just during that period in Paris, that the wedding had been fairly low key.
Yeah.
There's photographs you see of them standing with the registrar getting, you know, holding the certificate. There isn't a media scrum happening there. And again, if we go back to this idea that it's Paul and Linda's wedding.
Yeah.
Is the trigger for this series of events, and that you see the media, and they know the media will be fascinated by this. So it seems to spontaneously have come about in that sort of week to 10 day.
But what sort of happens around that Amsterdam bed in is they kind of pivot over into this chronicling of their lives, which they kind of become famous for in a way, because we start to get, you know, essentially because the press are called, but we get a lot of coverage of the bed in, and they do start to document their lives as a almost as an art piece itself.
This is it. This is the point at which John's life, his life with Yoko, becomes, as you say, an art project. So, you know, the writing becomes more about what they're doing, the side projects that they're doing, Two Virgins, Life with the Lions. All of these things are just the artist is the art. That seems to be the underlying message that Yoko brings to him. And, you know, he's the product of an art student, an art college education. And there is this idea that, you know, his talent is there. We've had the two books, but it's in a sense, it's being constrained by the expectations of being Beatle John.
Yeah.
You know, he's written these two books. That there are only two books. It doesn't go further than that.
Yeah.
But it's meeting Yoko that gives him the confidence, or she gives him the confidence to say, well, yeah, if you want to do this, you should do this. This is what you should do. Or why not take all your clothes off on an album cover? Or why not document your own life in your art? That's what all great art is about, the artist.
And you're right, because the books are kind of seen as, I don't use the word novelty, but as you say, they're not used as a serious build. You know, there's the books, and then there's the National Theatre adaptation of In His Own Right, but they're kind of seen as I think culturally as, oh, it's a bit of a parlor trick. Look, but you know, he's written a book. He's the clever one. He's the literate one, but he doesn't necessarily leverage that into his art. It's really when Yoko comes along that he, as you say, follows this kind of art college thread.
Yes. I mean, he will say from time to time, you know, I saw myself, part of me is a songwriter, but the books and the writing is a separate thing. And even you see in those interviews when he's talking about the books or talking about the writing, he kind of ducks his head down and he's got a little bit of a grin, and he's self-conscious about these sort of literary pretensions, I suppose, as he would say.
But the other three
it.
Are kind of ribbing him in some of those interviews.
And the other three are kind of ribbing.
Like tearing up the book and all that.
Yeah, there's a very funny interview where George is kind of doing that with the book in the background. Yeah. And so, you know, it's that he wants to be taken seriously. He knows he has talent. He knows he is an artist, but he's self-conscious about it. And it's, you know, there's nothing less self-conscious than standing in front of camera, taking all your clothes off and putting on an album cover. So it's Yoko is saying, could sort of liberates him from those constraints, those conventional notions about, well, you're a singer and you're a pop singer. And stay in your lane. You know, that's what's required of you, and that's what you must do.
But it's also this notion of, you know, you can do them, and you know, the sky isn't going to fall. Like, certainly, you know, you might upset some people, but that's just part of the process. You know, you can still keep on and try and get to some truth. But yeah, you know, I think we need to look at that week in bed at the Amsterdam Hilton as, you know, where a couple of ideas take hold, the kind of the hyper documentation of John and Yoko's lives, the notion that they are the art themselves. And these are very much ideas that are at the core of this song, The Ballad of John and Yoko, that this stuff is interesting. This stuff needs to be documented. This stuff is the art. And we don't know exactly when he gets the idea to write the song, but it's certainly that cauldron of the bed-in would make sense, that it comes out of activities like that. Because the bed-in gets documented in a couple of different ways, doesn't it?
It does. Again, it's mentioned in this song. And then there is the wedding album that comes out later in the year, which is a very lavish sort of box set that, you know, and you get photographs of the wedding cake and drawings from there's a booklet and there's drawings. And the second side of the album is really a reportage. You've got little clips of interviews, you've got them singing little snippets of songs in bed. It's like an audio diary of what happens in that week. And this is where the John and Yoko brand, you know, if you think about John and Yoko, you tend to think of them either dressed the same in white.
Yes.
You know, they're dressed all in white and the long hair, he's got the beard, or else you picture them in their stripy flannel pajamas sitting in a hotel room with hairpiece and bedpiece written up behind them. Yeah. You know, which always reminds me of the Dylan cue cards in
Subterranean Homesick Blues. Yeah.
But this is where Brand, John, and Yoko
comes
about. And this is the point really at which they start calling themselves that. You know, that's all one word, John and Yoko.
And you know, the bedding is also documented in a book and in a film, isn't it? There's a film called Honeymoon.
Yes. Now, I have only seen little bits of this film, but this is it was directed by a guy called Peter Gersons, and it's just a montage of them wandering around singing, and you know, you get to see them sleeping in their bed, reading the newspapers. It's again, it's like a diary. There's also a fantastic photo book by Nico Koster, who seems to have been a journalist or art dealer or moving in art circles, and he was invited by John to come in and record what they were doing. And again, it's just a book of these very lavish photographs. I do not have this book. It's about £70, a very nice looking thing, but I've never convinced myself I need to spend £70 on a book of photographs. But it's they get a very sort of cooperative press, I suppose, at this stage. You know, again, there's a novelty and it's intriguing and it's funny. And even though the press must have felt slightly that they were being taken for a ride.
But John and Yoko are very clear, but they don't mind people laughing. They don't mind being clowns per se.
No. And they say that, you know, it's all done with humor. It's all done in a lighthearted way. And they are selling peace. You know, yeah. John talks about, well, this is a product. This is weird. You know, and there's footage in this film of him on the phone saying, you know, well, look, you just got to keep hammering home the message, and people sell us everything. They sell us tin goods, but they sell us war, and they sell us armies and tanks and guns. And all of this is being played out against the background, obviously, of the Vietnam War that's going on. He said, all of these things are on TV. It's propaganda. We've got to use that. We're advertising piece. Yep. And I suppose, you know, again, 50 years on, it all looks a bit naive, but it was a very radical approach.
No, I think 50 years on, there's still, we still see, you know, people talk about in current times about, you know, it's a battle for people's attention, you know? And so, you know, you take someone like Greta Thunberg, whether you're on her side or not, she's basically playing a game of getting people's attention and becoming a totem for, you know, provoking a conversation about those types of issues, whether it's in the press or around the dinner table or whatnot. I think John and Yoko perhaps grasped that earlier than a lot of other people, you know. And as we said, you know, it's something that still carries on today. You know, you think John and Yoko, you do think of the peace aspect of it. You think of the war is over if you want it aspect of it. It is branding and it is mass communication.
It is. And this is where it starts. And Happy Christmas, War is Over is really the end point. And it's in the middle, you know, you get Give Peace a Chance, and you get, so it's fascinating the kind of sloganeering that's going on with Happy Christmas, War is Over, Give Peace a Chance, even the phrase bedding.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hair piece, which is a kind of pun, you know, so everything is being done with humor.
Yeah.
And again, 50 years of hindsight, I think people can be a bit po-faced about John Lennon and about Yoko in particular. And we've touched on this, you know, on the Yoko episode, is she's quite willing to laugh at herself and she's quite happy that you laugh at her.
Yeah.
But as you say, she's got your attention and the message is getting across.
So next verse in the song, because they do their bed in up until the 31st of March, 1969, made a lightning trip to Vienna, eating chocolate cake in a bag, Newspaper said she's gone to his head. They look just like two gurus in drag. We don't know exactly if that's a verbatim quote from a newspaper, but it's the general tone of what they're talking about.
Yes, that would be a great quote. You'd like to be the person the person that came up with that. It strikes me that it's much more likely to be John's phrase than a journalist.
And but again, the rest of it is real, though. They do go to Vienna and they eat chocolate cake in a bag.
Yeah, that's what you do if you go to Vienna.
If Paul marries Linda, that's the end result, is going to Vienna to eat chocolate cake in a bag.
That's it. So this is the I remember the first time I heard this song thinking, what do you mean the cake was in a bag? The way you know,
from a high-end confectioner.
A high-end confectionery. That they didn't occur to me that they were in the bag. And then I began to think, that's very impractical. Like, there'd be crumbs everywhere. that's just...
This has gone too far.
I was 12 years old. I mean, okay. What was I going to know about this? But so this is they fly to Vienna. They stay overnight. They have a press conference. And you can see little sketches of this press conference in the stuff that comes with the wedding album. And this is where they sort of unveil this concept of bagism. So they hold a press conference from inside a bag, and John retrospectively would say this was his favorite kind of aspect of what they were doing on this whole trip. And we should say the chocolate cake, it was a very particular chocolate cake. They stayed at the Sacher Hotel. Okay. And there's something called the Sacher Torta, which is a very well-known, rich chocolate cake dessert. So again, you know, for our Nothing Is Real European tour, we'll have to do that as well.
Eating Sacher Torta in a bag, that doesn't scan quite
Doesn't scan quite so well. But there's two things. They're promoting there's a little film being shown on Austrian TV of their sort of antics, their honeymoon, but also they're there to promote the world premiere of one of their art project films, Rape.
Now we've mentioned this film before, but it's basically a woman being followed by a camera. Isn't that the...
Yes, sort of around the streets of London, through the park, into her apartment. This film is on YouTube. I have not sat through the whole thing. It's extremely uncomfortable watching. It's supposed to be a sort of satirical commentary on press intrusion and the sort of thing, I suppose, that John and Yoko would experience or perhaps had been experiencing. And again, you've got this dichotomy coming through. So on the one hand, they're saying, you know, come and see us in bed, that we can tell you all about what we want to advertise and what we want to promote. But on the other hand, they're making a film like this, which is about press intrusion and about the need for privacy and the fact that the press don't respect privacy. And I suppose this is still going on today, where you've got sort of the media or royalty or whoever it is you're playing with fire, you know, this does not sit comfortably with me, this film, particularly because, according to Yoko, this is a done without consent.
So the person in the movie doesn't know they're in the movie.
The person doesn't know. Now, that cannot be right. It's one thing to kind of follow somebody around the streets of London, stick a camera in their face, but they actually follow her constantly across an entire day. You'd go to a police station and call the police.
You'd kind of put your foot down at some point, maybe. But that's probably the point. Getting back to bagism, I mean, personally, bagism, I think is quite a forward-thinking radical idea, because I think it's something that a lot of the, that people could understand in a modern day era, because, you know, we're kind of living in a time where people are addressing issues of, you know, race or gender or identity and all the rest. Yeah. And bagism is essentially, at its core, is designed to be a deconstruction of identity and the filters of identity that cause people to have any form of prejudice. And so in modern parlance, I think that's something that people can understand.
I remember buying, I think sometime in New York City, and my father saying, you know, when I was 14 or 15 or something, my father saying this and going, oh yes, that's yeah, they're in that bag, you know, like, what's that about? And he couldn't understand this at all and thought this was just a kind of a stunt. But that's what he remembered looking back, kind of 15, 16 years on from the event. It was, oh yes, I remember them appearing on TV in a bag.
Well, as a kid, I would have thought, oh, they're in a bag. That's crazy. How do you drive a car? How do you do that? But that wasn't the point. Like, the, you know, once you kind of realize that it's metaphorical, and they're not saying we all need to live in bags. They're just saying we need to have our perceptions of these identities in bags so we can all peacefully coexist. Isn't that the point?
It is. We get, you're absolutely right. And particularly in the, you know, as you say, in this day and age, it absolutely taps into that. And you think that, you would like to think that today, if that was happening or that was being presented as a concept, that, as you say, people would get it. In those days, 50 years ago, particularly with the press, they were just kind of going, what, a bag? Well,
they were just taking it totally literally. It was just a literal, they're in a bag, I see.
Yes, absolutely. You know, like, there is a little clip of the press conference, a little extract on YouTube, and there's someone going, are there holes in the bag? And John going, well, there's a hole to get in and out. You know, that, they're being confronted with something that they just, there's no point of, no frame of reference for this whatsoever.
Yeah, and I think there's more of a frame of reference for today. Now, the bag as an idea didn't just start in 69. Sure didn't. That was an idea that was hanging around before.
It is. And I mean, it seems to me that this is quintessentially Yoko.
Yeah.
You know, she had been doing this kind of project, but the first time is late 68. There was a thing called the Alchemical Wedding, which was an underground artist's get together at the Albert Hall. It was the Arts Lab in London put it on. And again, it's this idea of challenging audiences to be participants in the art rather than passive consumers. So John and Yoko climbed into a large white bag on stage, sat, sort of hunkered down knee to knee, closed the bag and just sat there for 45 minutes did nothing. And that was their performance piece. And it was reported on the time. It said, musicians played, poets ranted, and John and Yoko crept into their white sheet-like bag on stage and stayed there out of sight for what seemed like ages. I watched a baby slowly crawl by, and that was the bag happening. So that was how it was being presented at the time. But it's this idea, again, Yoko's idea, one sees rightly only with the heart. The essential is invisible to the eyes. So,
as you say, the root of this idea probably comes from Yoko. And as an artistic idea, you know, it stands as one of Yoko, but you then introduce the most famous man in the world and stick him in a bag. It becomes a totally different idea because it's saying, you know, that fame is almost a prejudice. You know, so there's the concept of the bag itself, and then there's the concept of doing it with John Lennon, which is quite like, imagine the whole Beatles, all four Beatles in bags. It's quite wild. Well,
yes, because I mean, John looking back on this, and again, 1970, where he's doing that Jan Wenner thing, he said he says Vienna was a very square place, so it was a very strange scene, and they're going, is it really you? Is that you? Why? What are you doing? And we're saying, you know, well, this is just total communication. And they said, well, you know, can you sing? Because is it John and Yoko? Is it just two people?
Well, that's the thing. If you'd seen, you know, the Alchemical Wedding, would you say, oh, I saw John Yoko?
Yeah.
John and Yoko live, you know, does it count? And that's the whole point of the conceptual piece, I guess, you know?
It is sort of, you know, brain meltingly odd.
Yes.
Once you start thinking about it, because it is about, okay, this is just total communication because you can't see who I am. But the whole point of this communication depends on it being John and Yoko. On the one hand, they're saying, this is the most famous person in the world, and this is what's bringing people here, and this is what the message we're going to sell you. And then on the other hand, they're saying, but we're going to get inside a bag, so you don't know whether it's us.
And you know, through all of this, you know, I think they were sincere, even if they were playing it occasionally for laughs or for fun or just to see what would happen. But Yoko in 2015 said, you know, John and I thought after the bed-in, the war is going to end. How naive we were. But the thing is, things take time. It's going to happen. We're going to have a peaceful world, but it's going to take more time than we thought then. And as we've said, you know, the point is that we are talking about it now, you know, so that's what they wanted it to be, was just to get attention, you know. The last verse of the song starts with "caught the early plane back to London." But I think we're going to talk about everything that happens in London in our next episode, because not only is there still some events to happen in the ballad of John and Yoko, but you know, the song itself has to come into existence. And that's its own story, isn't it?
It's a whole
other bag.
It's a whole other bag.
There you go.
Hey. Well done.
Thank you very much. So that's the events around the ballad of John and Yoko. And, you know, if you're listening at home and you're writing all this down, all of this stuff is happening in about a 2.5 week period. It's quite wild and crazy. But when they catch the early plane back to London, that's where we're going to pick up the story the next time. We remain available in all the usual places, you know, our Twitter at Beatles Pod, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, our new website, nothingisrealpod.com, which has all sorts of links to past episodes, to extra bits and pieces, and ways in which you can support the podcast going forward. So check us all out, nothingisrealpod.com. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. We'll see you next time.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.